What's up, Shitpost listeners? This is Jared Holt back with another episode. On this episode, we're going to have Joe Mulhall. He's the head of research at Hope Not Hate, and he's out with a new book called Drums in the Distance. It's very good. We'll get into that conversation and more, but let's take care of some house up at the top. I might sound a little different on this episode, and that's because I'm switching to new audio production software. I'm also getting a new audio interface soon. This is just one of a couple changes that I'm making to try to upgrade what we're doing here at Shitpost, thanks to listener support at our Substack, shtpost.substack.com. In addition to audio upgrades, I've also brought in Sam Thielman to edit the newsletters that go out in between episodes. So those are going to get even better too. So before we jump into this interview here, I just want to give a sincere thank you to the people that have believed in this show, believed in this project, and have been able to support the show as we move forward. With that out of the way, we're going to talk to Joe Mulhall about his great new book. Links to where you can get it are going to be down in the description. So kick back and enjoy. Joining Shitpost now, we have Joe Mulhall. He's the head of research at Hope Not Hate and the author of a great new book that he was kind enough to send me called Drums in the Distance. Joe, first off, hi, hello, how are you doing? The pandemic's been rough on everybody. How are you holding up?
Yeah, I'm not too bad, actually. I'm in sunny London, believe it or not. It's actually bright sun, rare, but it's I'm not too bad, other than I haven't managed to get over to America in about 2 years now, which is the longest in a long while. So I'm missing everyone out there. But other than that, not too bad.
Yeah, I think not too bad is about as much as anyone can hope for these days. But let's talk about your book. Yeah. It's called Drums in the Distance. It came out very recently. Before we dive into what you cover in the book, can you introduce yourself to the audience real quick? Joe, who are you? What do you do?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Joe Mulhall. I'm head of research at Hope Not Hate. And basically, Hope Not Hate is an anti-fascist organization. We kind of monitor and research far-right groups in the UK. But, you know, as I'm sure you know, like, we have to look all over the world these days with the way these online networks work. So my job is running a team of researchers here that is setting out to kind of monitor, understand, and then disrupt far-right networks around the world, really. And yeah, that's my job.
And before we get into the nitty-gritty of the book, I always like to ask people why you wrote this book, which is about the global far-right. Why did you feel like you should write this, and why did you feel like you should write it now?
So, the first bit of that is, why did I feel I should write it? I mean, partly there's a huge amount written on the far right. You know, there's a new book every hour, it sometimes seems. But part of it, I was getting increasingly frustrated that I didn't think there was just quite an accessible book that told the story of far right, this phenomenon that was happening around the world in lots of different places simultaneously and tracing its roots back over decades, and kind of explaining how it is that we got here. And a lot of it was obviously decided the time was right, if you will, because of, you know, we had Trump in America, we had Bolsonaro in Brazil, we had Modi in India, and I was based in Europe, and we'd had years of the kind of growth, uneven, but lots of kind of growth of the far right electorally, and all these various movements we were seeing around the world, like the alt-right and the counter-jihad movement. And all of this stuff was happening simultaneously, and I felt there was lots of brilliant books looking at various elements of these different things, or various geographical pieces of the picture, but there wasn't a nice accessible book that kind of pulled them all together. So that was the idea when I started thinking about it. And then there was also the book that has a certain edge to it in that, as I said, I work for Hope Not Hate, and part of that job is researching the far right, but it also involves kind of infiltrating the far right. And that part of my job had kind of come to an end, which I was allowed to kind of write out a lot of the stories that I'd been sitting on for 10 years from kind of operations and infiltrations. So that the kind of two came together at that time. And then how it happened was, like, you know, I'm one of those really tediously annoying people that wrote it during lockdown when there was absolutely nothing else to do. I was kind of sat around in my flat in London and got writing, really. And so, yeah, I'm one of those people that say, what did you do in lockdown? I wrote a book, which I understand is extremely annoying for people.
Well, I want to compliment you on the book. It is, you know, for full transparency, I'm about half of the way through it, but everything I've read so far is really great. It really cuts that line between being like very dense and academic, which can be kind of hard for a general audience to approach, and also having, you know, these fun stories about you getting covered head to toe in paint, trying to cover up a mural, kind of stories from the road, like scrambling away from a bar as far-right activists chase you into a hospital, and all these little stories like this that make it really kind of accessible. And I think it strikes that balance really well. So you start the book, Joe, by taking a moment to try to be specific about terminology. And this is something that has come up a little bit more. I kind of broached in the last episode of my podcast with Joe Bernstein a little bit, but the way we talk about this stuff really does matter. And you make the point that it especially matters as, you know, we're thinking about what the government should do or what kind of response we should have to far-right movements or fascist movements and that sort of thing. And I was wondering if you could just kind of explain your thinking there and outline the distinctions that you see and maybe why it's important to make those distinctions.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it was one of those where I'd almost left this out of the book, right? Because as you say, the idea was it was supposed to be quite accessible, and I didn't want it to kind of bog it down at the beginning with, you know, a lot of books on the far right and the history of fascism and things that have chapters and chapters kind of engaging in these vast debates around how what we should call what and etc. But I did feel it was important to get into it a little bit. And as you say, the main reason for that is that I think how we define certain groups, movements, and individuals has a huge ramifications on how we oppose to coming at it from an anti-fascist perspective. What is acceptable or may work with one group, we will not be acceptable or another. And so part of my concern is that kind of the sloppy use of definitions, too many people being called fascist, actually stops us from being able to come up with ideas to oppose those individuals. Right? I'm saying most of the people in the book, or all the people in the book on the far right, I obviously dislike their politics, but it's about saying that there is a difference between, you know, in the United Kingdom, Nigel Farage, who was the leader of the Brexit Party, you know, he's xenophobic, he's racist, he's said kind of explicitly racist things in the past, but he's not a Nazi, right? There are groups that I talk about in the book and that we monitor in the UK that are explicitly neo-Nazi, right? And clearly, there's very different responses required to those two different people. They're not necessarily using the same tactics for so people that are so diverse. It doesn't work. And so I touched at the beginning of the book about essentially saying that everything in the book is about far right, but I use the far right in a very broad, it's an umbrella term that talks about, you know, groups and individuals that believe in nationalism, not elitism, you know, that they attempt to challenge the political system, both its institutions and its values, but especially political liberalism and egalitarian humanism. And there is this broad umbrella term. And within that, we have various different parts. You know, we have the extreme far right, and we have what you might just call the radical far right. And the extreme far right essentially reject the essence of democracy completely. That is, they completely reject popular sovereignty and majority rule, whereas the radical right does accept the essence of democracy, but essentially opposes fundamental elements of liberal democracy. So minority rights, rule of law, separations of powers. And obviously those differences there mean that we have hugely different tactics to how we oppose them. One of them we can beat at the ballot box. One of them might require more direct action, et cetera, because those groups aren't going to be engaging with us on a democratic plane. So that's why I talk a bit about definitions at the beginning. What we call people, I think, matters, because it's how we then talk about how we...
Yeah, I think that definitional question and kind of what you just got into there about how you oppose different parts of the far right differently, the radical extremist kind, as you rightly note, they don't participate in democracy the same way we might. So it's not a matter of, you know, vote them out or whatever. And I think this is kind of throwing people for a loop, because especially here in the US, it seems like far right movement sentiments are continuing to gain steam. There was a sentiment for a while that maybe with Trump out of office, this would lose its engine. But, you know, just in the last week or two, Fox News host Tucker Carlson has been getting all kinds of criticism, rightfully so, for peddling great replacement theory, which I don't have to tell you, Joe, but I'll tell the listeners, has been the engine driver of several recent white supremacist mass shootings. You know, when you have that kind of material going into primetime cable news and reaching presumably millions of people, being echoed by elected officials, I think that kind of gives people a little bit of pause or maybe a little bit of confusion over, like, well, how far right could it be if it's on Fox News every night? Or, like, is this fascist? Is this not? And I think people kind of get hung up there and almost, like, don't know what to do. It's almost like they get paralyzed into inaction. And I'm curious what your thoughts are, having seen, you know, a lot of this stuff sort of rise up, go back and in and out like a wave, like extremism tends to do in the UK and all over the world. If you have any thoughts about what's happening in the US and how we should think about that.
I think the Tucker Carlson thing is worrying, right? And of course, it's not just Tucker Carlson. There's numerous people in the Republican Party that have been kind of flirting with this great replacement theory for a while. And it's interesting, right, in that this theory, this kind of notion that this process that indigenous Europeans, as it was originally formulated in France, but, you know, now, of course, the Western America as well, is being replaced by non-European migrants. It's another example, actually, of how European far-right philosophical ideas have gone across the Atlantic, right? And one of the things I talk about in the book is saying this is a global movement and we have to understand it as such. And I remember years ago when we used to talk about the rise of the alt-right, you know, it was obviously a very American movement. But a lot of the philosophical underpinning of it came out of the European far right, the French New Right, the Nouvelle Droite. All these ideas, in some senses, have been quite marginal since the 1968, when the group started to emerge with them. And then they started to become much more mainstream in North America. But this is another good example. You know, the Great Replacement is something that we hear in Europe being talked about by identitarian networks, identitarian movements, and the proper far right. And, you know, occasionally it'll leak across the line. So to hear it on something like Fox News and within the Republican Party, I think it's pretty terrifying. And when you sort of say, well, like, where's the line between fascism, etc., one of the reasons that I think this specific idea is so dangerous is, at its core of the Great Replacement, it is saying you are being replaced. Right? And if you don't get active, you're going to be replaced. There's going to be a genocide against you and your people. Now, for some people that engage in this idea, the way you get active is you drop a banner, you wave a flag, you go on a march. But for other people, like, for example, the Christchurch shooter, right, in New Zealand, who killed dozens, active to stop replacement meant was going out and murdering Muslims in a mosque, right? And so this is like, while I think these definitions of radical right and extreme right, they are fluid, right? They are not, these movements are not distinct. Things, the ideas move in and out of them and they influence each other. And so Tucker Carlson, when he's talking about these things, as I say, for some people, it will be that we need to deal with this the democratic way. It will be within the radical right. But for other people, clearly, these ideas are signposts towards saying we have to get active to stop our own genocide, and that requires violence, right? In which case, he's speaking to both the radical right and the extreme far right at the same time. And just to see it so normalizing in America, you know, as I say, these are ideas that we've been talking about and looking at and watching in Europe for decades often, but very marginalized spaces. It's another example of something going across the Atlantic and in that very kind of America, everything's bigger than it is in Europe. All of a sudden, it's on Fox News, and we're hearing it in the Republican Party, which is pretty worrying, you know.
Yeah, it definitely is worrying, because my concern is that, you know, even though, I mean, like, mass extremist murders and stuff, right, they are but a small fraction of general murders that might happen in any given country, but they have a particularly political and disproportionate violent effect on the communities that they target, which are often minority communities. My concern is that, like, even if 0.001% of Tucker Carlson's audience thinks like that, when you scale it up to millions of viewers, you know, even if we have just like a few hundred people or a thousand people that start to get those ideas, it could be potentially very dangerous.
Hugely, right? Because it's not just, there's the individuals, as you say, that small number, which will take it in the most extreme way and might want to act on something like that. There's that element there. But there's also the longer term insipid effect of normalization and mainstreaming. Like, once these ideas break through the cordon sanitaire, right, and enter into the mainstream, trying to put them back in the bottle is extremely... What he's doing there is normalizing far-right, like very explicitly traditional far-right ideas. And once they become normal, it's very hard to convince people, once again, that they are unacceptable, that they should remain beyond the cordon sanitaire. So it's not just the thousand that might go off and get very involved. It's this longer-term normalization, this drip effect on American society, where extreme-right ideas stop being shocking. And they start becoming increasingly normal.
And if they become too normal, they become policy, and then we're really in trouble.
Exactly right.
On a brighter note, maybe it's not so much of a brighter note. I would love for you to share your story of setting up a fake KKK chapter. The KKK is these days just seems ancient as a hate group in America, but it does still exist in some places. In the book, you go through and you talk about your time kind of infiltrating into the KKK, and I'd love for you to share that story with listeners.
Yeah, sure. It was a strange one. So it was 2016, and it was in the run up to the Trump election, and all eyes from people like ourselves in the UK, but all over the world, were obviously looking at the Trump election and seeing how, or increasingly worried how it was going to affect events around the world in terms of the radical right movements that we monitored. And the book tells the story of actual three kind of simultaneous infiltrations, two in America. One was the anti-Muslim group ACT for America. I went and spent some time at events. I went down to the border of kind of the New Mexico-Mexican border with a militia group from Alabama called the Border Keepers of Alabama, and I tell that story in there. But the other one was this really strange story, which was, and you say they're archaic, right? The way I actually made contact with them was by posting them a letter. And what we were interested in the UK was, because obviously it's not our job to get, you know, to do a huge amount in America, except for in this election thing, as I say, everyone was very interested in it, but there's obviously groups in America doing great work on this stuff. I was more interested in the UK, because of the branding of the Ku Klux Klan, if you will, every 20 years or so, a small little Ku Klux Klan branch pops up, and they have done throughout the 20th century, you know, and it's invariably kind of a couple of neo-Nazi individuals or groups that have got a more Christian element to them, and they start to venerate the KKK, and you see these little groups emerge. And I was interested in whether or not we currently had anything active in the UK. So I wrote letters to all of the major American clans, essentially just professing to be a British kind of far-right extremist, really interested in loving the Ku Klux Klan, and wrote to them and said I'd be really interested in, you know, lots of them wrote back letters and sent us repulsive stickers and etc. But one of them, the Loyal White Knights of the KKK, which was set up back in 2012, and they were one of the most, or they claimed to be the most active in the Klan, in America, sorry. And he was really, really keen. They were linked into neo-Nazi activism as well. He writes back and he was so excited that there was this guy in Britain really interested in it all. And we kind of, at Hope Not Hate, we set up a little fake blog that was like supposedly outraged that these Klan stickers were going up around London, which of course they weren't. Because Chris Bark would send me the stickers, I'd put them on lamppost, take a picture, take the sticker down, and then send it back to him in America. And so he was getting very excited that, you know, all of a sudden he was expanding across the Atlantic. Of course he wasn't, it was being run by us. But then I would say, you know, so eventually it kind of gets to the situation where I'm essentially running this fake clan in Britain as far as he's concerned. And he sent me some contact. No, this is a weird one. I don't put it on the CV. but he then started to send me some details of other Europeans he was in contact with, and so we started to get that sort of information. And then, as I say, I end up in America doing some, like, an infiltration of the Border Keepers of Alabama, this militia group. And so I'm in and around America, and by this point, like, I'm regularly in contact with them, Chris Barker, the Klan, or, like, via email, etc. And they have this website. And I was actually kind of on the run a little bit from this group in Alabama, and was hiding out in this kind of abandoned water park in Indianapolis. And all of a sudden, I checked my fake email account, and Chris Bark has given me the login details to the back end of his website. So I kind of then log in, and there it is, everything, every single member, their real name, their picture, their location. He just kind of emptied all this stuff on, and it was kind of like welcomed me in to say, like, you know, you're now one of us, which was obviously a stupid idea. So we obviously then screened lot and pulled all the information, and then not long after we managed to publish it in the UK, and we didn't publish all of the names. We obviously had a huge amount. We published lots of the pictures of the more leading figures, etc. And we have obviously real problems with far-right extremism in Europe, of course, but even we were shocked by the extremeness and the vitriolic kind of violent racism that we were finding in these closed forums that they were kind of introducing us into. And of course, it was hugely about Obama at the time, as he was the president and stuff. But it was, in one sense, it was comical, because we then published it. And I remember at the time, you know, they came out and blamed it on these two other members. He didn't seem to work out straight away that the random English guy that had turned up might be the mole. And so he started blaming other people. And so I just decided to email every member of the Klan saying, by the way, it was us, and it was all Chris Barker's fault. He let us in, because they didn't even vet me. So, you know, so I think it was that and a number of other things turned out to be quite damaging for Chris Barker. It was an interesting one for us to kind of really behind the curtain. But from an operational perspective in London, it was useful to find out exactly who was flirting with the Ku Klux Klan within the UK far right as well.
You know, I think that's a perfect story to kind of get to the next thing, which is kind of the premise of the book. You know, even this archaic like dinosaur of a hate organization like the KKK in the US was trying to see, you know, influence over in Europe. And it, you know, that is just one kind of microcosm, one, you know, example, but it kind of speaks to the global nature of the far right. And even if it is not always readily apparent that it operates on a global scale, instances like those show very clearly its aspirations to do so. You know, for people that live in the United States, Americans tend to have like really bad news habits of like not reading news that of things that happen outside of our borders and that sort of thing. You know, what would you stress to people to try to understand about the global movement as it exists and sort of how we should think about that?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think this is the big question, right? And I can understand when, you know, when you look at like the Southern Poverty Law Center's hate list, there is so many groups. I can understand why people interested in stuff in North America can take a very American perspective on it. It makes sense. There's an awful lot going on. And the argument I make in the book is that actually, to genuinely understand, you have to think globally, right? Because for a long time, you had collaboration between far-right groups around the world. You'd have a British group collaborating with a French group, writing letters to an American group, etc. What we've seen in recent decades is the emergence of networks which are genuinely transnational from the way they are created. They conceptualize the problem in a global sense or in a Western sense, certainly in a cross-border sense. And they collaborate often outside of structures like traditional far-right groups. They don't have leaders as such. They don't have like formalized organizational structures, but they are post-organizational. They connect and collaborate through these movements and networks around the world or using various online platforms. And so, you know, when you talk about Tucker Carlson, for example, you know, talking about the Great Replacement, that's not because he is in an organization. Organization of a far-right group in France.
Right.
It's that these ideas, ideologies, essentially move around the world, which is on the internet, and ideas and influence can start in one country and move to another. And I think the best example of that is I mentioned the Christchurch killing in New Zealand, you know, 51 people killed, 49 people injured. If you look at that specific attack, right, I think it gives us a good example of what I mean here, right? The attacker was Australian. But if you read what he wrote, he was inspired by the actions of the British terrorist Darren Osborne. He talked about the Swedish school murderer Anton Lundin. He obviously talked about the US church killer Dylan Roof, as well as, of course, Anders Breivik from Norway. Right? And then when you read his manifesto, he talks about how his ideology was derived from this, you know, old British fascist called Oswald Mosley. But he also mentions the 14-word slogan, right, which is obviously popular and created through the US white supremacist movement. He talked about anti-Muslim politics from the international counter-jihad movement. And of course, he was highly influenced by European identity, like generation identity. And then you track through his history, right? And before his attack, he spent time in France, Croatia, Bulgaria, Hungary, Bosnia and Herzegovina, all of which in various ways influenced his politics, right? And then when you go through the terrifying and shocking and tragic list of people he murdered, there are, of course, Muslims from New Zealand, but there was also migrants and refugees from Pakistan, India, Malaysia, Indonesia, Turkey, Somalia, Afghanistan, I think Bangladesh as well, right? That Christchurch attack was a truly international tragedy, right? And it was, while it was perpetrated by one guy, it was genuinely motivated by a global far-right, right? And so this is why, if we really want to understand the modern far-right, you know, it's not just about who's the kind of local far-right guy on my street, what's the issue in my community? Those are really important questions we should be looking at. But it's not even just what's about my country. We have to go beyond our street, beyond our countries. We have to go beyond traditional organizations and think about works and movements, because ideas and ideologies shift around the internet in seconds, and movements emerge and create things like this attack. They kind of, it's an individual, it's a single a mosquito, but it's emerging out of a global swamp. And I think that's really important for understanding the contemporary far right.
Joe, I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on the role that the internet plays in this dynamic currently. My theory, or I guess armchair take, is that, you know, this global dynamic of the far right existed before the internet, but like so many things, when we talk about extremism and the internet, or I mean, frankly, even like cooking in the internet, the barrier to entry is way lower, and there's the hurdles are like almost taken completely off the track, where normally if you wanted to join a militia group, you would maybe have to go to a gun show, or if you wanted to get in touch with like French fascist philosophers, you'd have to like scour bookstores or maybe like know somebody who has a catalog you can order from. And now you can get to it in seconds. And that kind of speeds up the process and helps it scale faster than it normally would. How do you view the role of the internet as it pertains to the global far right?
No, I could not agree more with what you just said. The far right has always been international in some sense, right? You know, I mean, if you go back even to the 20s and 30s, of course, there was huge amounts of interconnectivity between various fascist groups around the world, you know, letters and groups and meetings, etc. The internet did not create the international far right, but it did a couple of things. One is, as you say, I think it's just remarkably lowered the barrier to entry. The ability, the ease with which you can find the content that can either radicalize you or further radicalize you, or once you're in the movement that you can engage with, is so much easier than before. As you say, if you wanted to, I mean, I always think Holocaust denial is a good example. If you wanted to engage with Holocaust denial literature before the internet, you either had to go to, in the UK, something like a National Front meeting or an extreme far-right meeting. You had to write a letter to a Holocaust denial institution in California. The one important thing there is you knew who they were. You knew, first of all, that they existed. And then you also knew that they were deemed to be extreme and deemed to be ostracized and deemed to be on the far right. Now you can go on any social media platform in existence and you'll find Holocaust denial if you want to. And in some cases, you'll stumble across Holocaust, which again is a fundamentally different thing. You wouldn't stumble across Holocaust denial previously. You had to go look. So the amount of content you can find, either by mistake or with the cursory search, I think is as hugely changed the access and the ease of access to this material. And then also, I think you have these super sharers. People in the far right had long disliked Islam and Muslims. But what the internet did is, it wasn't just that like a group in England were angry about halal chicken nuggets being served in a school in Burnley, right? But they can also now just be instantaneously angry about halal chicken nuggets being sold in a school, or given out in a school in Warsaw or Stockholm or Lisbon, right? And they would have never have known about that 20 years ago. But now they know about it and they see it every day, and it drip feeds into their feed every morning and they see it. And all of a sudden it shifts this idea from, there's a problem down my street, to there is a global crisis. And I think that also feeds into some of the speed of the radicalization we see and the extremeness of where people end up. So the internet didn't create the hatred that lies within these movements, and it didn't create the contacts between countries. But it made it easier, it made it faster. And in some senses, I think we now have this fetishization of it being more extreme as well.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. Because it takes some, these isolated incidents that they might get upset about and throws it into a global crisis type of frame. And that type of crisis can definitely drive people into more extreme action. I've been speaking with Joe Mulhall. He's the head of research at Hope Not Hate. Go get Drums in the Distance. It's a great read. I've been enjoying it so far and should be finishing it shortly. But Joe, this is Shitpost. So before I let you go, what's your favorite thing on the internet right now?
Favorite thing on the internet? You know what it is? This sounds really sad, right? But I only came across this guy recently on TikTok. And I know I'm too old for TikTok, but there's this guy called Francis Bourgeois, right? And he's this kid that likes trains. And I don't have any great interest in trains, but when the internet is just awash with horrible, awful stuff, the GoPro stands by train lines and then gets extraordinarily excited when they toot their horn when they go past him. I absolutely love it. Whenever I'm thinking, oh God, do I have to watch another awful video? If I just go and quickly look at his content, I guarantee you it'll make you happy. The guy's called Francis Bourgeois, right? And it's just really happy, wholesome content. So that's what I've been watching this week to make myself feel better.
Great. Joe, shoot me a link to that. I'll drop it in the description of this episode so that all of the Shitpost listeners can be comforted by horn trains or train horns. Well, Joe, thanks so much for joining. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks for having me.
That was my interview with Joe Mulhall. You can find him online. You can find his book and Hope Not Hate. Those resources are all down in the description of this episode so you can pull it up and get there quickly. That's all I've got this week. And if you've listened this long in the episode, I'll give you the little treat of knowing that our next guest here in a couple weeks, as long as everything goes to plan, is going to be the infamous Vic Berger. If you've got questions for Vic Berger, we're going to sit down for a more casual conversation. Send them my way on Twitter or one of the 1,000 ways to contact me or the show, and I'll try to work them in. But until next time, this is Jared Holt. Thanks for listening.